So, I want you to picture this. It's 1944.
Okay, setting the scene.
Right. And there's this guy, Bryant Harcourt, and he's standing in the cupola of this incredibly old, incredibly creepy manor house. And there is a massive thunderstorm raging outside.
Classic haunted house setup.
Totally. But he's not just like watching the rain. He is actively conducting a
Oh,
séance.
wow. During a thunderstorm. That seems dangerous.
Yeah, which, as it turns out, it really was, because right in the middle of it, lightning strikes the house's lightning rod, and the sheer shock of the whole thing triggers a massive fatal heart attack, leaving Bryant dead and his spiritualist partners basically just fleeing the town in absolute terror.
That's a wild piece of local history.
You're right, but here is the crazy part. Fast forward decades later, and a group of local kids are using the architectural blueprints of that exact same house to play this really elaborate game. Or, well, at least the adults around them think it's just a game.
And that tension right there, that disconnect between the mundane, kind of boring assumptions of the adult world and the incredibly high stakes, deeply serious business of being a kid. That's the core of what we're unpacking in today's deep dive.
Exactly. Welcome to the show. Today we are looking at this fascinating, highly detailed log that tracks the intersecting lives of a group of kids in the mountain town of Ainaton.
And really, the mission here is to figure out how these kids navigate the absolute boredom of small town life. You know, the
Yeah.
chores, the Sunday church services, the trips to the local library.
Ugh, the worst.
Right. But they're doing all that while simultaneously conducting these rigorous investigations into local lore.
Yeah, and I want you, the listener, to think about your own neighborhood for a second. Like, how many strange architectural quirks or weird local rumors do you just walk past every single day without a second thought?
Tons of them, probably.
Right. But what these kids are doing is stopping to actually look at them. And to set the stage for you, we start in literally the most mundane setting imaginable, a Sunday morning church service.
Specifically at the Church of Jesus Christ Redeemer. And we meet Thomas, who mostly goes by Tom and his friend Agatha. And they are enduring what sounds like a phenomenally tedious Sunday school lesson.
Oh, the source material paints this picture so vividly. It's so relatable.
It really is. We are talking construction paper Jonah and the whale cutouts.
Yeah.
And the kids are getting, like, maybe a bit too aggressive about making the paper whale spit Jonah out.
Yeah, truly.
Yeah. And this is all combined with a sermon about, quote, knowing God's will, unquote, that the pastor inexplicably decided to dust off early for the high schoolers.
It is the ultimate portrait of a captive audience. Your body is physically trapped in this room, but your mind is just desperate to escape.
Totally.
And the second that benediction ends, Tom makes a break for it. But first, and this is so funny, he has to survive what the source brilliantly calls the post-church gauntlet.
Oh, the gauntlet.
You know this gauntlet?
Huh.
It's that endless barrage of handshakes from older adults telling you how much you've grown and pointing out that you desperately, desperately need a haircut.
And Tom's handling of that gauntlet actually tells us a ton about his character right off the bat. He doesn't argue, he just smiles and delivers this highly practiced suck answer.
Which is.
He tells them his hair has a mind of its own. He understands exactly how to perform for the adult world, just enough to placate them and secure his freedom.
Right, which he does. He breaks free, changes his clothes, and grabs his backpack. And this isn't just a bag to hold snacks. This thing is fully stocked. He's got a compass, a rope, a Swiss Army knife, and this painstakingly copied map.
He's prepared.
Super prepared. So he heads to the edge of town to this massive ancient tree known as the Gnarly Tree, and he immediately starts practicing his stealth.
Yeah, he's actively gliding his feet between leaves, lifting branches so they don't snap.
Yeah.
He's treating the woods as a hostile or at least like a highly unpredictable environment.
Yeah.
But his solitary scouting mission gets derailed almost immediately.
Right, because he's up in the branches, scouting the location for a hidden platform, when he spots a girl walking down the path. And it's someone he briefly made faces with at church earlier. She's a visiting relative of the Winters family.
And she is operating on a completely different frequency than Tom.
Entirely. She is stalking imaginary prey, licking the back of her hand like a paw, and periodically just announcing the word meow.
Just meow out loud.
Yes. And okay, let's unpack this for a second because I read this exchange and I have to push back a little on how we interpret their interaction.
Okay, how so?
Well, Tom drops down in the tree and introduces himself very officially as Lord Explorer Thomas of the Golden Hawks.
Right.
And the girl, without missing a single beat, lifts her chin and declares she is Bragwaine, familiar of the Sorcerer of Anduin.
Right, they established their roles.
But is this really a shared fantasy? Because Tom immediately starts treating this like a hard-boiled interrogation.
That's true, he does.
He asks if her sorcerer walks with a limp, because he's been out there tracking. He's seen tracks in the dirt, indicating a cane. To me, Tom acts like a seasoned detective trying to extract operational intel from an uncooperative informant in a back alley.
Yeah.
But the informant just keeps insisting, I'm a cat.
You know, you're picking up on a really crucial friction there. It's not a seamlessly shared fantasy at all. They are actively negotiating the rules of engagement. Tom wants hard logistical facts, and Bragwaine just wants to remain in character.
Exactly.
But the reason Tom takes her seriously, like the reason he doesn't just walk away from a random girl pretending to be a cat,
yeah,
is because of a physical piece of evidence. Bragwaine is wearing a very specific silver charm around her neck.
Right. It's this intricate Celtic-looking pattern of two fish, or maybe serpents, and they're swallowing their own tails, and Tom instantly recognizes it.
Because that exact pattern matches the wax seals on a series of mysterious puzzle letters that Tom has been finding lately.
Yeah, these marks left around what he considers his realm.
Right. And that charm takes Bragwaine from, you know, just a random neighborhood kid playing pretend to an active participant in an ongoing mystery.
And she drops the facade just enough to admit they've been studying Tom. She reveals that her sorcerer is the boy Tom saw at church with the leg braces, who is later identified as Maximilian Winters.
Max.
Right, Max. And she says Max leaves these puzzles because he has a, quote, concern for quests.
I love that phrasing.
It's so good. He is actively testing Tom to figure out if he's pure of heart, strong of will, or to use Bragwaine's highly technical term, to see if Tom is a hero or just a fuddy-duddy.
A fuddy-duddy. And the psychology of that motivation is fascinating. If Tom is a fuddy-duddy, he fails the test, the game ends, and the sorcerer goes back to paying attention to Bragwaine.
Right. She wins either way.
Exactly. But this revelation completely shifts Tom's reality. He realizes he isn't just an explorer mapping empty woods. He's being watched, evaluated, and orchestrated by a mastermind.
Which means just wandering the woods is no longer going to cut it. If Tom and his friend Agatha are going to figure out what this sorcerer really wants, they need data.
Hard data.
Yeah, they need to transition from the fantasy of the gnarly tree to the cold, hard archives of the Anaton Public Library.
And the library itself is this incredibly imposing structure. The source describes it as a massive neo-Gothic labyrinth, complete with gargoyles.
Goo-goo.
Very. But the real obstacle isn't the architecture. It's the 15-year-old library assistant, Ginny Hortons.
Oh, man, Ginny. She is a nightmare obstacle for a kid trying to do serious research. She uses that saccharine, sweet, entirely fake voice to talk down to Tom and Agatha, basically treating them like toddlers who are about to spill juice all over the reference section.
Typical teenager power trip.
Oh, 100%. But while they are actively dodging Ginny's line of sight, they spot Maximilian, the sorcerer himself.
And what is the mastermind doing? He is sitting at a heavy oak table, completely surrounded by topographical maps of Anaton, taking meticulous notes from a thick volume on the history of the Holy Grail.
See, that is wild to me. He is cross-referencing local geography with occult history.
Right.
And that completely validates Tom's paranoia. Max isn't just playing in the dirt. He is running a rigorous academic investigation. So Tom and Agatha realize they have to match his level of scholarship.
They have to step up their game.
Exactly. So Tom dives into the history of Harcourt Manor, which is this old, decaying house he's actually helping to restore in real life.
And that's where he uncovers the story we started the deep dive with. The manor's history is incredibly dark. Built in 1884. Then in 1929, the son, John, loses the family fortune in the stock market crash and jumps out of a skyscraper.
Awful.
Yeah. And then Brian Harcourt takes over, starts hosting seances, and eventually dies at a heart attack during that 1944 lightning strike.
So while Tom is pulling property records on basically haunted houses, Agatha is looking into a local park called the Siege des Anges.
Right.
And she discovers the architect, Mortimer Bonney, arrived during the gold rush and claimed the entire design for the park came to him in a dream. It's laid out as three interlocking circles representing the Trinity, with a fourth circle representing mankind.
So let's look at the mechanism of what's happening here. The kids are taking the abstract history of their town, you know, the seances, the suicides, the architectural dreams, and treating them as literal, factual puzzle pieces.
Yeah.
Agatha even pushes the boundary further. She asks Tom a very logical yet kind of terrifying question. Mm-hmm. If the architect got the design in a dream, who exactly sent the dream? could actual angels have shown him the blueprint?
And here's where I have to play devil's advocate for a second.
Do it.
Aren't the kids just suffering from massive confirmation bias here? I mean, they are hyped up on the sorcerer game. They go to the library specifically looking for ghosts and magic. And shocker, they find a 1944 heart attack and an eccentric architect.
That's a fair point.
Even Tom pushes back on Agatha. He says, "This is dreams, Agatha, not radio. How?" He's really trying to stay grounded in reality. He is. But Agatha challenges that grounding. She asks if anyone really knows where dreams come from. And the brilliant thing the source material does here is blur the line between recorded historical fact and supernatural possibility.
Oh, absolutely.
The history is real, right? The interpretation is what's up for debate. But regardless of whether it's angels or just eccentric architects, Tom realizes a fundamental truth. You cannot conduct a war or, you know, a magical investigation without infrastructure.
Right. Ideas and topographical maps are totally useless if you don't have a headquarters to store them in. You need a physical base of operations.
A fort.
Yes, a fort. And this brings us to the harsh logistics of childhood. You can't just build a fort. You need raw materials. And arguably more importantly, you need zoning permission from your parents.
Always the biggest hurdle.
Yep. Tom's dad immediately shoots down the idea of a backyard treehouse. But Tom's mom offers this brilliant, albeit very labor-intensive, trade.
So the church desperately needs to clear out its basement to build a new Sunday school room. And it is just filled with decades of accumulated junk.
So much stuff.
Right. Tom's mom tells him that if he hauls out the garbage, he can salvage the heavy plywood backdrops from the old Easter and Christmas pageants to use as the building materials for his woodland fort.
And this entire basement cleanup scene is phenomenal. It acts as a perfect microcosm of local community dynamics. You see everyone's true colors based on how they handle manual labor.
Oh, completely.
You've got little kids like Peter, who instantly abandons the work, unpacks a box of old costumes, shoves a battered papier-mâché Roman centurion helmet over his eyes, and just runs blindly around the room.
Chaos. Pure chaos.
Yeah. And then you've got Agatha precariously balancing on a massive stepladder, basically risking a broken arm just to change a burnt-out light bulb so they can see into the dark corners.
And then you have Tom dealing with the gritty realities of moving dead weight. He and an older martial arts practicing kid named Genji try to lift a rotting cardboard box full of heavy hymnals, and the box literally disintegrates in their hands.
Ugh, the worst feeling.
It's a logistical nightmare.
But it's also where Tom really proves he's a leader. He performs this brilliant bit of social alchemy. He knows Ginny Hortons, remember? The condescending library assistant.
Oh yeah, she's roped into this cleanup too.
Exactly. And she is awful to work with. But Tom notices a chemical reaction. Ginny acts significantly sweeter whenever the older, cooler Genji is around.
Teenage crushes.
Right. So Tom strategically pairs Ginny and Genji together to carry the heavy loads up the stairs. He mixes two volatile elements to neutralize the explosion. It keeps Ginny happy and out of his hair so the rest of them can actually work.
That social intelligence is just as vital as his Mac reading skills.
Definitely.
And his reward for this labor is uncovering the quote-unquote good stuff in the back of the basement. The discarded pageant props. They find plywood boards painted like starry night skies and Herod's palace. They find a fake tomb.
Classic church basement finds.
Right. And most importantly, they find a rusted pulley system with heavy ropes from an old flying angel harness.
And just consider the brilliant irony of what Tom is doing here. He is literally salvaging the physical discarded debris of his town's religious history. Painted wooden skies and theatrical angel harnesses. And he's using it to construct a totally secular, potentially magical headquarters out in the woods.
It perfectly encapsulates how kids process the adult world. They take the structures adults have abandoned and repurpose them for their own mythologies.
Yeah.
And Tom isn't just pretending either. He looks at that rusted angel harness and instantly whispers to Agatha that they can use the heavy pulleys to engineer a working elevator for the treehouse.
So cool.
His imagination is wildly creative, but it is firmly anchored in the laws of physics and engineering.
Oh, yeah. He's making lists of tools to borrow from their dad's saws, hammers, specific types of nails. But a fully engineered pulley-operated fort is just an empty wooden box if you don't have a crew to occupy it.
That's right.
So, having secured the raw materials, Tom shifts from an engineer back into a recruiter. He has to assemble his party.
Which brings us to the sidewalk outside Tom's house. He's got his backpack, he's ready to hit the neighborhood, and he runs into Alice. Alice is a younger, blonde girl who approaches him holding a brown paper bag. She's brought him monster cookies as a peace offering to apologize for a previous argument.
The detail in these cookies in the source is so specific and charming. They are shaped like terrifying monsters and dragons, but they are completely smothered in pastel pink and blue frosting with little cheerful smiley faces drawn on them.
It's the perfect edible metaphor for Alice herself.
It really is. She is the optimistic heart of the group. But she also drops the heaviest thematic line in the entire deep dive.
She does. She mentions their neighborhood mentor figure, a man named Mr. Kooning. And she tells Tom, Mr. Kooning said we can play whatever we want, and believing it maybe makes it real.
Believing it maybe makes it real. That is the thesis statement of their entire summer.
Yeah.
If Alice is the believer of the party, holding the group's faith together, we also have to talk about the element that grounds them in absolute reality, which is Shadow, Tom's black cat.
Oh, Shadow.
Shadow joins them on the sidewalk, and the source material spends a surprising amount of time detailing this cat's behavior.
Because the cat acts as the anchor for the magical realism. Think about it. If everything in the story was mystical, it would just float away into pure fantasy.
Right, it needs grounding.
Exactly. But Shadow behaves with hyper-realistic feline indifference. He flattens his ears when Alice pets him too enthusiastically. He completely ignores the meticulously baked monster cookies, which forces Tom to continually remind everyone that cats are carnivores and do not eat baked goods.
And then Shadow executes a flawless, tactical cat trap.
Yes.
He just flops over, entirely dead weight, directly onto Alice's feet. He pins her to the sidewalk with 10 pounds of fur and an upside down head, totally immobilizing her.
It's so funny.
It's a hilarious, frustrating, entirely real moment that just interrupts their epic quest. But eventually they extract Alice and continue gathering the crew.
Right. So they pick up Eleanor next.
Wait, I have to interrupt here because the source refers to Eleanor as a Ruritanian exchange student. We really need to clarify that for a second.
Good catch.
Yeah, Ruritania isn't a real country on a map. It's a fictional kingdom from old 19th century adventure novels, like The Prisoner of Zenda. So Eleanor isn't an actual foreign exchange student. She's a local kid deeply committed to playing the role of an aristocrat from a made-up European country.
Exactly. And it just shows the depth of the personas these kids inhabit. Eleanor is the cautious observer of the group. She prefers birds and actively avoids the grumpy cat.
Smart.
Once Eleanor is secured, the party moves on to recruit Simon. And Simon represents the highest real-world stakes of the group so far.
Oh, for sure. Simon is the jester of their court. But Simon has a massive logistical problem. He has been grounded for an entire week by his notoriously mean, beer-bellied uncle.
And his crime.
According to his uncle, Simon was burning boats.
Which is quite an accusation.
Right. So when Tom knocks on the door, the uncle literally slams it in their faces.
But the quest doesn't stop at a closed door. Simon's head pops out of his second-story bedroom window. And he doesn't just wave goodbye. Simon physically sneaks out of his window, propping the frame open with a wooden ruler so he can get back in later.
The ruler. That's such a great detail.
Yeah. He is risking severe, genuine punishment from an angry guardian just to join Tom and the girls on their expedition to the old cave where the sorcerer's puzzles began.
Let's analyze the psychology of that choice for a minute. Simon isn't sneaking out to go to a party or do something traditionally rebellious. He is risking his physical safety and well-being to protect the integrity of the game.
Right.
That absolute, unshakable loyalty to their shared world is what tries these kids. It elevates their actions far beyond just, you know, mere summer boredom.
They're taking their own curiosities completely seriously. When you look at the diverse skills of this party, Tom, the logistical explorer, Alice, the believer, Eleanor, the cautious observer, and Simon, the risk-taking jester, it flawlessly echoes the structure of a classic mythological quest narrative.
It really does.
They aren't just neighborhood kids. They are an optimized unit designed to uncover the truth.
And I think that journey offers a phenomenal blueprint for how we investigate the world around us. I mean, think about the ground we've covered today.
That's a lot.
We started in the stifling, trapped environment of a Sunday service, just desperate for an escape. We followed Tom out into the wild, where he encountered Bragwaine and the physical evidence of the sorcerer's test.
And from there, we realized that imagination isn't enough. You need data. So we moved into the dusty archives of the public library, digging up the morbid, lightning-struck history of Harcourt Manor and debating the origins of dream-inspired architecture.
Right. We navigated the exhausting, highly political manual labor of a basement cleanup, dodging condescension, mixing volatile social elements, and literally carrying the heavy boxes of hymnals just to earn the discarded plywood for a woodland fort.
all for the fort.
Yep. And finally, we watch Tom recruit a specialized team willing to risk real-world consequences to face the unknown.
You know, if you are trying to map out your own realm, whether you're diving into a massive creative project, investigating a niche hobby, or trying to understand your own community's history, it requires this exact cocktail.
Yeah.
You need wild, boundary-pushing imagination, but you also need cold, hard research, social intelligence, and a willingness to do the heavy lifting.
But there's one final, incredibly provocative thread woven through all of this that we need to leave you with.
Let's hear it.
Throughout all these sources, whenever the adults in Ainatin look at Tom, Agatha, Alice, and Simon, what do they actually see? They see children playing an elaborate game of pretend in the woods. They see kids moving junk in a dusty basement to earn a favor. They see them reading history books to pass a slow afternoon.
The adults are entirely blind to the overarching narrative. They are dismissive of the details.
Right. But what if Max, the boy with the leg braces, studying occult maps in the library, isn't just orchestrating a complex game to test his peers? What if this town, with its history of fatal seances, its parks designed by mysterious dreams, and its intricate silver pendants showing up in the woods, is actually built on top of something profound?
Like, what if these aren't just local ghost stories?
Exactly.
It forces you to wonder.
Yeah.
What if the kids, by virtue of their obsessive curiosity, are the only ones paying close enough attention to notice that the puzzle pieces of their town actually fit together?
Think back to that stuffy Sunday school room we talked about at the very beginning.
Oh, yeah.
The adults are perfectly comfortable sitting inside, listening to the same predictable, mundane reality they'd accepted for decades. But what if the kids, the ones staring longingly out the window, are the only ones who realize that the wild, impossible, magical mystery out there is the actual reality?
Now that is a thought that changes how you look at your own backyard.
It really does. Keep your eyes open, take your own curiosity seriously, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.